This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailhards on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon, and it is good to be back. A big thanks to the rest of the team for their work keeping the program thriving while I was off busy welcoming the newest addition to our family, a baby girl, Margaret. We are all doing well, and no, we are not sleeping. A little bit of business to start the program today. If you do keep wanting to listen to the cricket, you can do that on the ABC Listen app. Just search for ABC Grandstand. You can find the details there or online as well. Plenty to talk about on the program today. I'm keen to know if you've had much rain over the course of the weekend, and whether that rain is needed right now. You can send us a text, 0467 842 722, the text number, 0467 842 722. To start today, though, Australia's first national deer management coordinator says she'll look to create a national feral deer management plan as part of the new job. Dr. Annalise Wiebken from South Australia's Department of Primary Industries and Regions has had her job funded by the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions. She says she will add to the support and advice that's already available.
It's really to promote the issues of feral deer and what we can do about controlling their numbers, and also to build capacity among communities that are affected by feral deer problems by helping them with strategies and tools, building our knowledge and opportunities and that sort of thing for communities that want to do something and where they have concerns, and also to build coordinated approaches to deer management so we can get governments and industry and communities at all levels working together to control deer where there are problems.
Annalise, as a part of your role, you're putting together a feral deer management action plan. What is the goal or the ideal outcome that this action plan will hope to achieve?
Sure. So this will be a national action plan. So it will involve a lot of consultation with many different stakeholders from industries and communities and governments and at all levels. And also we'll be working with a steering committee and jurisdictions as well. So it will be a really collaborative action plan. So we want to work out how everybody wants to achieve feral deer management across the country and how it can be done and what are some of the issues to achieving this. And we want to work out what the shared goals are. We probably all know that different communities are going to have different issues, and as well there's different legislation across the country for managing feral deer. So the action plan is going to be flexible enough to incorporate all those things so that community programs to control deer where there's problems will meet their needs.
Will that flexibility come at the expense of hard solutions that will hopefully achieve some progress in managing feral deer?
I don't think so. I think there are some key principles that will be consistent across the board, and one of them is likely to be that control programs need to be really coordinated. One of the reasons for this is because deer cross property boundaries fairly easily. They don't respect property boundaries and easily jump fences. And so controlling deer at the property level, particularly if it's a small property, is not as effective as doing it with all your neighbours in a large group, because if you just do it in one property, you're likely to get deer in re-invading your property after all that hard work. So we will encourage communities to work together with their neighbours and find shared solutions that are community-led and community-developed so that they have strong motivations to sort of carry out their plans and support them in that. Yeah, so
essentially, is it going to work alongside local management initiatives that are already in place?
Absolutely, where we can do so. Integrated pest management is really important, and you get a lot of benefits by working with existing programs where possible. Absolutely.
Can you paint a picture for me? How much of a problem are deer nationally?
Sure. Well, it really is a patchy picture. So in some places, deer are a real problem. They're really visible and they're causing problems to farmers, to conservation areas, and they're causing problems on the roads. So, and then in other areas, they're not very visible at all and they're in quite low numbers. I mean, deer are quite elusive, and they tend to be active more in the evenings and at night time. So many farmers may not even know that they've got deer visiting their primary production, and gardeners might not know who's nibbling on their vegetables. So deer in some areas are in quite low numbers, and in other areas they're a real problem. Part of the role is to make people aware of the impacts and enable opportunities to try and tackle the problems before they get too big. Now, in some places, as I mentioned, they are a big problem, and there are management programs that are going on already to try and tackle them. So I really hope we can help those communities where deer are not yet a big problem so that our efforts are more effective now.
If all these different regions that are affected by deer do have some local measurements or managements enforced, why is your job needed?
I think that when communities have strong buy-in and motivation to participate and get involved, we tend to get much better outcomes, I guess, when people really want to be involved. And so I think by working together and providing support, we'll have longer lasting outcomes to reduce impacts of deer.
What sort of management practices and tools do you expect communities to take out of this?
Hopefully communities can be really involved in the in a management plan for their own area and do it together. So there are several options that are available, including using contractors or commercial harvesters or volunteers. There's aerial control programs, there are traps. You know, you can even use infrastructure with better fencing to direct them or keep them out of areas. So there are several things that communities can do, and I think it's important that they decide what goals they want and what resources and timeframes and what they want to do with managing the feral deer, and then coordinators such as myself or other local coordinators that we've got around the place can help and support them through that process and through those plans and sort of invigorate them to carry out those management plans that they develop. So there are many people in different regions around Australia in communities that have deer problems that are available to help. And in South Australia, we have a state feral deer coordinator, and she's been doing great things with communities, revving them up and encouraging them to get together and find solutions for their own little patch. So I will be supporting people like that across the country and trying to build on those programs that are already happening and get new ones happening as well.
That is Centre of Invasive Species Solutions National Deer Management Coordinator, Dr. Annalise Wiebken, speaking there with Bridget Herman. Rainfall texts are more than welcome on the program today. How much you've had over the course of the weekend and whether or not you need it right now. The text number 0467 842 722. 0467 842 722. MJ says 15 millimetres at Moyston, still plenty more required. If you would like to get in touch, the text number is 0467 842 722. It's a bit of dairy news now. Dairy processor Fonterra has announced that it will be selling its Chinese farms for $500 million. Inner Mongolia Natural Dairy Co. has agreed to purchase Fonterra's two farming hubs, and separately, Fonterra's also agreed to sell its 85% interest in its Hangyu farm to Beijing Sanyuan Venture Capital Co. Fonterra CEO Miles Hurrell has admitted the Chinese businesses has not performed as well as they'd hoped, saying in a statement, quote, "We don't shy away from the fact that establishing farms from scratch in China has been challenging, but our team has successfully developed productive model farms." The company says China is still a focus and that the money raised will be used to pay down debt.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 12:15. My name's Nikolai Bailharts. Well, to one of the real blessings and curses of 2020, even for land care facilitators, video conferencing software, things like Zoom, have of course allowed land care meetings and workshops to continue. And while some farmers say they don't really particularly enjoy using it, at the same time, it has opened up access to overseas presenters who normally wouldn't come to Australia. Peter Somerville spoke with East Gippsland Regional Land Care Facilitator Emma Orgill about how she used the technology.
Well, they've been running for for a little while. I think we've been running them for about a month already. But it started when I was working with Nat Jenkins and Penny Gray on a topsoil project, which is funded through the National Landcare Program. And we got Grant Sims to talk online about cover cropping. And from that, we got farmers saying they want to learn more about nutrients and foliar spraying and soil organics. So we got Joel Williams to come in. And to get around the whole, because we can't have field days, we've been doing one-hour webinars a week for a month. So we've run three already with Joel Williams every Thursday morning at 8:30. We've got a fourth one coming up next week on Thursday, which is New Thinking on Soil Organic Matter. It's for an hour. If you want to register, just contact me. And we record it and then send out the recording if you can't make that specific time, because who knows what happens in the world of farming. But from that, we got an understanding that people wanted to know more about soil biology. So we're getting Christine Jones. She's starting Sunday, actually, the 11th of October, with just the basic ABC of soil health. So for anyone that hasn't got any understanding of soil biology. And from there, we're running two a week on, and each one will be a case study of a local farmer and talking about how they've increased soil carbon, soil biology, and Christine Jones will go through that. And they're, I think, on a Tuesday and Thursday. Joel Williams is sitting in Canada while he talks to us. I believe Christina Jones is in the United States. So we're taking advantage of this opportunity that normally would cost us thousands and thousands of dollars to get them to come here in person.
Yeah, so would you be able to get them here normally in person?
We would. Joel Williams hopefully will be coming July next year, but that's only if he can fly in from Canada. So I've already booked him. But Christine Jones is someone that we might normally be able to afford, specifically for this amount of events we're running. So this is an advantage.
Of course. And for you as a land care facilitator, how do people react to this, to being able to see and interact with people that normally work overseas and may not be able to get here? Do people like that opportunity?
Some farmers are lapping it up, absolutely loving it. I've got one farmer from Omeo that is just loving them, because she normally wouldn't be able to go to days like this if we ran them down in Bairnsdale. We've got other farmers that can't stand Zoom, but they might watch the recording.
It sort of brings flexibility that you wouldn't normally get otherwise as well.
Definitely. I mean, once everything goes back to normal, we will be using this tool. I find it a very valuable way of reaching certain people within the community. It gives them the flexibility. They can watch it whenever they want. They can listen to it while they're driving to somewhere or on the tractor. They don't have to view it. It works quite well even as a podcast. It's a really valuable tool. I do think face-to-face is better, but not. I'm still saying this is a thing we'll be using in the future.
And speaking of face-to-face, if we maybe move on to the Women in Agriculture group, talk us through how you've kind of adapted that away from, unfortunately, away from meeting face-to-face and taking it online but keeping it engaging.
The East Gippsland Women in Ag Network has been running for a couple of years, and we've been doing field days and farm visits and leadership training, and it's all very face-to-face. So when we became an online COVID community, the Women in Ag did not translate at all. The women are homeschooling, they're talking to their bankers online. The last thing they want to do is do downtime online. So to adapt to that, I have a speaker, Robin Moore. She's a brilliant speaker. She's from Tasmania, and she's done pre-recorded a one-hour webinar that I can send a link out to people. It's only going to be online for about 2 weeks, and then they can watch it at their own time. So it gives them that flexibility that maybe when they sit down with a glass of wine, when they've got the kids to bed, they can watch it. And if they want to get together, we're going to do a one-hour happy hour on the 14th online.
Happy hour? How could you dispute that? So during happy hour, you come together and obviously have a drink, but discuss what you've learnt as well?
Yes. Robin will be there. She'll facilitate. The message Robin's giving in that 1 hour is all about resilience and recognising that farmers, well, all of East Gippsland, have had a pretty hard time of it with drought, fire, COVID and everything else. She just talks about family, the importance of recognising times are bad but trying to see the good in things as well. She's got a great little message, and that's kind of what the Women in Ag group is all about.
That's Emma Orgill from Landcare speaking there with Peter Somerville. A quick update on the cricket scores. A wicket has fallen. Natalie Dodd's been bowled out. So New Zealand in the second women's ODI, Australia against New Zealand. New Zealand now at 1 for 80. So New Zealand now 1 for 80. A couple more rainfall texts through as well. In Pat's backyard in Ararat had 14 millimetres overnight. And Jill's been in touch too. Tynong North, 11 millimetres. And Jill says we have actually had enough, at least for the moment. 0467 842 722 is the text number.
The Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailharts on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, a new pear variety that can be eaten crunchy, soft or juicy is now being planted on farms. Cutie pears, spelt Q-T-E-E, have been planted in Europe since 2015. But now growers in South Australia, Victoria and WA have jumped on board to try and be amongst the first in Australia. General Manager of Horticulture Brand Management Australia, Elisa King, says the greatest barrier for consumers to buy pears is not knowing when they're at their best ripeness to be eaten. But she thinks this new variety could change that.
The cutie pear actually originates from Norway. It's a medium-sized fruit and it has an intense, beautiful red blush with a green background. I think the thing that is great about this pear is it can be eaten hard and crunchy, or it can be eaten soft and juicy. The pear has a sweet, aromatic flavour.
Why is this new variety introduced to Australia? Is there demand from consumers?
We believe that there will be, and one of the reasons why is consumer research in Australia shows that the biggest barrier to purchase a pear is that consumers actually don't know when they're ripe. And because this will be a controlled planting and we will have very high quality specifications for the fruit, we'll be able to guarantee that every pear will either taste great when it's eaten crunchy or when it ripens and it's eaten soft and juicy. So we think we will that barrier to purchase will be solved by this pear.
And where will this new pear be planted?
The new pear at this stage, we are planting it in Victoria, in Shepparton, and also in the Adelaide Hills, and then across in WA in Manjimup. And we will plant there, but we will see where the best place is for it to grow, because it has been grown in Europe and they do have different conditions to Australia. So we believe that they're the best locations to plant in, and we'll trial it over the few years to come.
Managing Director at Ceravolo Orchards in the Adelaide Hills, Tony Ceravolo, is among the first to plant a new pear variety, and he believes it will give consumers and growers new opportunities.
I think it's just something different. The blush on the pear is very appealing. The colour with the blush I think is nice, and it gives us a little bit of a variance on the shelves as well, where we need a different point of difference. It's all green pears, which people have been mostly know about. Buribosch pears are a very nice cooking pear, but this pear comes in a little bit earlier in the year and it's a good keeping pear, so we should be able to have it for quite a few months of the year.
How many trees are you going to plant?
So at the moment, it's only at the early stages. We're still doing some trials, so we've got around 400 or 500. But we normally would like to put in at least 3,000 to 5,000 trees per year in the next 5 years.
What are some of the major challenges growers in the pear industry currently face?
I suppose one of our biggest challenges is the weather. The droughts that we've been having is certainly a challenge. Idealistically, we'd like to net all of our trees, and the government has assisted growers in that part, which is good for South Australia. We need that as a protection. We seem to be getting storms every year with a little bit of hail. Labour is a big issue at the moment. I think it's going to become a very big issue moving forward after the COVID.
And what does consumer demand for pears currently look like?
I think pears is a very stable line. It's great for all of us, really. It's good for your digestive system. They're a beautiful fruit to eat when they're at the right ripeness. I think people don't quite understand enough about pears. A pear needs to be a little bit mature for them to eat really nice. I know a lot of the younger people like very firm, very crunchy. But a pear almost got to be a little bit mellow and to get the optimum flavour out of it.
What kind of potential do you think this new variety has in regards to consumer demand and just bringing something different onto the market?
I think as far as consumers, they're always looking for something different. So I think it's exciting. It is certainly something different, and I think it's got a lot of potential to be a good growth category moving forward.
When are you expecting to see your first crop come off the trees?
Well, we'll probably pick 2 or 3 pears next year. We had 6 trees that came in probably a couple of years ago now, so we should be able to see just a few pears off them just to have a look at them. But I have seen them when I was overseas, and I did like them, and I can't see any reason why we can't grow them, if not probably a bit better because of our weather conditions here. But yeah, look, we're just going to get a few off this year. That'll be 2021 will be the first ones coming off, and I think we'll be into production probably around 2023. I think it's exciting for growers and consumers that these new varieties are appearing. Some of the old varieties will slowly fade away, but it's just the characteristics of the pears as well. Good keeping. Look, you can have them crunchy if you want in country. They'll still be sweet, but when they just do ripen on the table and they mellow up a little bit, they are really, really nice to eat.
That's Tony Schiavolo. He's Managing Director of Schiavolo Orchards in the Adelaide Hills, ending that report by Jessica Schremer.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 26 past 12. Australia's native pollinators, like the stingless bee, are facing a loss of habitat. But the potential threat posed by introduced and feral populations of the European honeybee is less known or understood. Now an Indigenous station owner in the Top End says they've noticed a big decline of native stingless bees in the area and that the honeybee is to blame.
We'll go and wait there for them. Here, look,
what? What tree are we looking at here, Frank?
It's a pandanus tree, palm tree. At this time of the year, this tree should be big and red, a nut.
There are nuts on it, but they're yellow, kind of almost turning orange, but not red.
Not red.
And they should be.
They should be red.
Indigenous station owner and Garawa man Frank Shadforth is seeing the bush change for the worst on his station on the Gulf of Carpentaria, 1,000 kilometres southeast of Darwin. Trees at Seven Emu Station don't blossom when they should anymore, and he's put it down to a decline in the number of native bees that call this tropical ecosystem home.
It's all to do with that feral bee, you know, the honey man that goes out and put the bee out.
Right, and you're talking about the European bee.
Yeah, he takes too much off that tree, and he's a very aggressive bee. And he also, I've seen, attack that male bee, the male native bee. I've seen him attack him to take the honey.
And is it just bees or is it lack of rain or factors?
No, he's that bee. Like we used to hunt and gather food through during the dry and drought, never made any difference. You know, people would say, oh, the cyclone. It's not the cyclone, it's that bee. See that tree there, this gum tree, he should be flowering there. You know, you can see the trees are not healthy no more. Mm. And that's because of that bee problem.
How long have you been noticing this change on your country for, Frank?
Oh, nearly 30 years now. Been gone like 30 years.
Yeah.
But in the last 20 years it got worse and worse.
The European honeybee, Apis mellifera, has been in Australia for roughly 200 years. But its distribution and abundance has risen dramatically over the last 80 years. And even after two centuries, the science isn't settled on the full impact feral populations can have on native pollinators and plants. Caroline Gross is a professor at the University of New England, and she's been researching the potential impacts that introduced bees can have on native ones since 1986.
The evidence is not clear-cut, and I've come to the conclusion that much of it is to do with the context. In some systems, it's been shown that honeybees can impact upon the native bees by being aggressive at the floral interface. And we've found this in North Queensland on a little shrub called Melastoma. And there what we found was that the honeybees would be quite aggressive and almost sumo wrestle their native bees from the flowers. And this was all over the resource of pollen, because melastoma doesn't have any nectar. So there, the native bees would have to spend more time foraging to get their payload. But what the next step of those sorts of studies is to look at the impact of the aggressive encounters on the fitness of the native bees, and that's work has not been done so much.
In a situation where co-foraging is leading to native bees being outcompeted by introduced bees, is there any impact on potential impact on pollination of the native flora?
It could be. The work that we've done on honeybees, for example, on feral honeybees, while they can be good pollinators of weeds, they are often not good pollinators of native plant species. So people may have seen honeybees in their gardens going for grevilleas and so forth, and they'll often just go straight for the nectar at the base of the flower and miss out on collecting and the pollen and transferring pollen in that visiting sequence. So what that can mean is that the resources are getting usurped and there's not enough nectar there to attract birds into the system or other native bees into the system to forage on those flowers. So there can be a variety of ways that honeybees might impact on the fruit set and seed set of native plants.
Back at Seven Emu Station, Frank wants his account to prompt more action to save Australia's native pollinators.
Well, I feel very, very sad, really, and upset, because I've got grandchildren. To my knowledge, I reckon we're going in a very serious problem, getting in a very serious problem if we don't take this serious. Yeah.
That's 7 EMU Station owner Frank Shadforth speaking there with John Daly. More of your rainfall texts coming through on the text line. Andy, 20 millimetres at Croxton East. Don had 6.5 millimetres at Rainbow, says welcome for the crops in the gardens, perhaps not so much for haymakers. And similarly on that note too, Rob's had 27 millimetres at Borken in the southwest of the state, bogging the motorbike in paddocks now. We need 2 weeks of 20-plus degrees to try and get some silage done. We'll get an update from the Bureau of Meteorology about the likelihood of that very soon. But first, we need to get the latest in news headlines with Eden Hennan. Afternoon, Eden.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. Welcome back. A Shepparton resident is among today's new cases of coronavirus and brings the total number of active cases in regional Victoria to 4. Victoria's Chief Health Officer Brett Sutton says the new case is being treated as a positive case but is still being investigated. The 14-day rolling average for regional Victoria is now at 0.3. A 19-year-old boy who admitted to 2 charges relating to the death of a disabled man at his Central Victorian home will be sentenced next month. The boy is one of 2 teens charged over the death of John Burke, who died after being stomped on and punched at his home in 2018. On Friday, the boy pleaded guilty to home invasion and recklessly causing injury after he accompanied his co-accused into Mr. Burke's house and repeatedly stomped on his leg. A woman is dead after a car crash south of Ballarat. 2 cars collided on Colac Ballarat Road in Napoleons just after 8 o'clock last night. The female passenger died at the scene and both drivers were taken to hospital with minor injuries. The Victorian Government has welcomed news that tomorrow's federal budget will include $1.1 billion for Victorian road and rail projects. The funding includes money for the Warrnambool and Shepparton rail upgrades, as well as a number of smaller projects in Melbourne. The Transport Infrastructure Minister, Jacinta Allen, says work will begin as soon as funding is settled. Students who attend standalone primary schools in rural and regional Victoria have returned to on-site learning today as part of the easing of the state's COVID-19 restrictions. Primary school students at P12 colleges will return on Thursday and secondary college students next Monday. Students will be able to stagger the return of different year levels depending on local circumstances. The state government has dropped more than 4.5 tonnes of eucalyptus seeds in bushfire-affected areas in the largest reforestation project in Victorian history. The seeds were spread by helicopter over 11,500 hectares in East Gippsland and the state's northeast. For more news anytime, you can head online to abc.net.au/news.
Thanks so much, Eden Hennan there with news headlines. Now, let's head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Senior forecaster on duty is Michael Efron. Afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Nikolai.
We've had a couple of rainfall texts through so far, no one with any really huge totals, but keeping in mind that some people don't really want huge totals at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. The highest falls have been down across the southwest, especially through the Otways, 31 at Mount Sabine overnight, Mortlake 27, Portland 26, Camperdown 26 as well. So pretty wet down through the southwest, even into the central district as well in the Melbourne region. We saw around 10 to 15 millimetres, but through the northwest, generally less than 5 millimetres through parts of the Mallee. Walpiup had 5, Swan Hill 0.4, so really did drop away significantly through the far north. And since 9 a.m. we have seen that rain contract to eastern districts, and the highest falls have been across the Gippsland High Country, Mount Useful 13, Snowy Range 10, and Mount Hotham 11 millimetres. So I think we'll see another couple of millimetres in that region, but we are really seeing that band of rain starting to weaken. And for the rest of today, across western and central parts, we'll see isolated showers over the south. Not expecting too much more in terms of rainfall, just 1 or 2 millimetres really. Should be mostly dry through the far northwest. But the main feature today really is the cooler conditions as well. So there's still a sheep graziers warning out. And for much of the state, only in the low to mid-teens. Looking at some of the temperatures around the state at the moment, 9 at Ballarat, elsewhere, Sheoaks, also 9 degrees, Warrnambool on 11. It is still reasonably mild through the north, and we are looking at a top this afternoon of 19 at Mildura, elsewhere, Echuca 17, Wangaratta 22. So some warmer air still through the far northeast, but for most of Victoria, a cool day today. And into Tuesday, we'll see the shower activity lingering through the east of the state initially, but then that will actually extend further west throughout the afternoon and even get into the far northwest of the state, although I think far southwest should stay dry. We'll see some isolated thunderstorms as well quite early in the day through the far northeast of the state, and through those eastern parts tomorrow another 1 to 5 millimetres expected, although across the ranges could actually see up around 5 to 15 millimetres at places like Falls Creek and Mount Hotham, even up to Albury-Wodonga as well. And another cool day for Victoria with temperatures around 15 to 19 degrees and minimums around 4 to 7, so a chilly start on Tuesday. During Wednesday, we actually see a low-pressure trough over northern Victoria starting to deepen throughout the afternoon and evening. That draws a lot of tropical moisture down from the north of the continent, so it is looking like an unsettled day on Wednesday. Rain and isolated thunderstorm activity extending from the north. Looking at a mild day, tops around 17 to 21 degrees, but the feature will be that rainfall starting to come down from the north. I think we're looking at around 10 to 25 millimetres across much of northern, northeastern Victoria. Through the northeast ranges, we could actually see totals of around 20 to 40 millimetres there. And then as we head into Thursday, we're going to see that low continue to deepen and track south across the state. So further rain expected, some of that actually becoming heavy across the ranges, and we could see falls of around 30 to 50 millimetres across the northeast on top of what's already fallen on Wednesday. So it does look like a fairly wet couple of days, Wednesday and Thursday, with some warnings likely to be issued tomorrow in terms of potential riverine flooding across the state. I think the far west and southwest are only looking at relatively light falls over the 2 days. Most of the focus will be through central and northeastern parts, and on Thursday, in terms of temperatures, still fairly mild, up around 18 to 21 degrees. And then as we head towards the weekend, we'll see that low moving away to the southeast. Friday, we'll see west to southwesterly winds. Most of the showers will be over southern and mountain districts, temperatures 16 to 20 degrees. And then does look pretty settled over the weekend, slightly cooler on Saturday compared to Sunday, with the winds initially from the south but tending northeasterly on Sunday. So a bit happening over the next week. Wednesday and Thursday in particular, very active across the state.
Yeah, and you touched on this, but does anyone miss out on that rain on the Wednesday and Thursday?
Yeah, I think on the Wednesday and Thursday, probably won't see significant totals through East Gippsland and also through the far west and southwest. So down towards Portland, Hamilton, even Horsham, not looking at the heaviest falls, although Horsham probably more likely to see upward of maybe 10 to 15 compared to those areas further to the southwest.
Okay, thanks so much, Michael.
Thanks, Nicholas.
Michael Efron, Senior Forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology. And a few more of your rainfall texts have come through as well. If you'd like to join that conversation, let us know how much you've had. 0467 842 722 is the text number. Fred at Werrimals had 10 millimetres. Someone else has had 13 at Ballyang, says it's great for the crops. Arthur had 21.5 millimetres last night, and an interesting story as well. He says, thought I'd maybe had one too many beers a little while ago. I looked out the kitchen window, thought I'd gained an alpaca, but it was a deer. Don't know where it came from, don't know where it's gone. What an adventure. 0467 842 722 is the text number. And just a quick update on the cricket scores as well. The Australian women's second ODI, Australia versus New Zealand. New Zealand batting at the moment, 1 for 112.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Nicolai Bailharts for the Victorian Country Hour.
Where it is 19 to 1, and speaking of rainfall and rain, it'll likely come as not much of a surprise to irrigators in Gippsland's Macalester Irrigation District that Lake Glenmaggie's almost full. The storage is just over 95% of capacity. And with that, Southern Rural Water has announced spill entitlement for MID farmers who can order spill water until October the 8th. Southern Rural Water's manager of Water Supply East, Gavin Pryor, spoke with Rio Davis about the extra entitlement.
Today we're in a situation where Lake Glenmaggie is operationally full, and we're unable to announce spill entitlement for the Macalester Irrigation District customers. So what that means is that any water that's been utilised by the customers since the start of the season until we're going to put a date of Thursday, 8th of October, is considered to be over and above the customer's 100% allocation. We announced their allocation at 100% for the start of the season, so give customers a good opportunity to start plan their water use for the year. And the recent rainfall and the wet outlook has enabled us to manage the storage level using our release strategy plan and bring that to the fore. So we've made some controlled releases throughout the time. And now we're in a situation where we've hit our target date and we're able to offer spill entitlement to customers.
So does that mean from the 8th of October, that's when farmers' entitlements will start for the next year?
So we'll review again on the 8th of October, and spill entitlement may extend past that, or it may stop for a period of time and then it may start again. But it kind of depends a little bit on customer demand and the weather for the next couple of months. We have been told that by the Bureau that it's going to be a bit wetter than average, so we'll see how it plays out. To obtain the spill entitlement, customers must make an order through our water line system and also make sure that they take the water through the outlet that they've actually ordered. That way the spill water will be accredited to that meter reading when the meter read comes in. So that's the important thing to remember for spill entitlement.
How much water's been released for environmental flows?
So the environment used up a lot of their carryover water at the start of the season. That's a normal practice for them to have a release early in the season. And the other water that's gone past there has, yes, been benefit to the environment.
That's Southern Rural Water's Gavin Pryor speaking with Rio Davis. A few more rainfall texts through. Some relatively high totals, really, in the scheme of what we've been talking about today. Ellerslie in the southwest of the state, 30 millimetres. Heather says 21 millimetres at Dunkeld. What a spring. It's beautiful. Good to hear. And 28 in the gauge at Pernham West near Warrnambool. 0467 842 722 is our text number.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
We're at 16 to 1. Well, cattle producers are being encouraged to look for signs of pestivirus in their herds. If it's not managed, it can lead to livestock deaths. Agriculture Victoria's district vet, Jeff Cave, says despite it being quite a widespread disease, it can be eradicated easily enough.
Pesty virus, it's actually quite a widespread disease, and we would probably find that in our beef herds, it's because it's a disease of cattle, that a good 80% or so of herds would have it. So the herds that have been closed for some time, or the herds that have taken the steps to eradicate the disease, wouldn't have Pesty virus. But many others do. And the presence of Pesty virus in a herd can do a few different things, mostly depending on the stage in which the animal was infected with the virus.
So what is it exactly? How does a cow get it?
So Pesty virus is a viral condition. It's a condition which is excreted by cattle and then picked up by others. And if they're infected for the first time, they'll develop usually a fever, a depression, diarrhea, not a particularly severe disease, and we know that as bovine virus diarrhea. And from there, those animals will go on to develop an immunity to Pesty virus, and so, yeah, it's a disease that may affect them, particularly that initial time. But the real concern with Pesty virus is if a cow, when she's pregnant, is infected with it for the first time, and that can have an effect on the unborn calf.
So is it something that's just in the sort of soil or environment, is it?
It's something that's excreted by cattle themselves. So they'll excrete it in their feces, the virus. Then others, if they're infected for the first time, will come along and become infected. So I've mentioned what happens with bovine virus diarrhoea. If you've got a cow that's pregnant, well, then it depends upon what stage of pregnancy she's at. So if it's in the latter part or the second half of pregnancy, the calf and her will both develop an immunity to Pesty virus, but it's possible that the calf will be either born with birth abnormalities or sometimes it can cause late abortions. But then if a cow's infected in the first half of her pregnancy, at that stage the developing calf's immune system hasn't developed, and so it doesn't recognise the virus as such. And as a result of that, the calf will be born a carrier of the virus. And listeners may have heard of the term a PI calf or a persistently infected calf. That's how a PI calf is produced. And in a herd, they are the main source of virus in an infected herd, because a PI animal doesn't have the immunity to fight off the virus, and so it produces a large amount of virus.
I understand if things get pretty bad, there can be, the disease can lead to another kind of disease and cause death.
Well, that's right. So with the PI calf, often you can pick them in a herd because they'll be a poor doing, stunted. Often they'll have sort of a dull hair coat, although sometimes they'll actually look like quite a healthy animal. And some PI animals can go through even into adulthood without ever looking sick. But since they don't have an immunity to the disease and they're producing virus, since they don't have an immunity, if they're exposed to a more aggressive strain of Pesty virus, they can go on to develop a disease known as Newcastle disease, which leads them to have diarrhoea, fever, a few things like that. And that can actually be a fatal disease. And the other thing about it is that some of the clinical signs include lesions on the nose, mouth and feet. And because of that, those lesions can even be suggestive of exotic diseases. And so it's doubly important to seek veterinary advice if you see a calf with clinical signs like that, so that we rule out the possibility of an exotic disease.
And so to prevent these diseases, what advice do you have for farmers?
Well, there's a few ways of managing Pesty virus. It's actually not a particularly difficult disease to eradicate from a herd. It's possible to eradicate it from a herd. And the way of doing that is to identify all of the PI animals, the persistently infected animals, remove them from the herd and basically vaccinate the rest of the herd. But many producers choose to have their herd live with the virus, and that's equally well manageable. I think the important thing then is to make sure that the cows or heifers are not exposed for the first time during their pregnancy. And so a way of ensuring that is either vaccinating against Pesty virus or making sure that the heifers are naturally exposed to the infection before they're first joined. So there's a couple of options there of managing it as well.
That's Agriculture Victoria's District Vet Jeff Cave speaking with Shuri von Hirschner.
You're with Nikolai Bailharts for the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, it's no secret that there are plenty of trends when it comes to farming. Riverina soil chemist Mark Conyers says he's seen plenty of people in the agricultural industry jump on and off different bandwagons over the years. He spoke with Cara Jeffrey, he's now retired, and she asked him what he's learnt during his 3 years working as a soil chemist.
I don't know how many times we discovered subclover decline was due to disease, acidity and poor nodulation. I don't know how many times we discovered subsoil constraints and the need to apply amendments like lime and gypsum at depth. It seems to come round. They used to say it was a generational cycle, but I think it's now accelerated to about every 10 to 15 years we go round again.
And so what are the big picture things that farmers and researchers need to get right that you've found in your experience?
I think it's getting the whole picture right. There are always fads and bandwagons. Carbon is the present bandwagon, and we've had soil acidity as a bit of a bandwagon. We had salinity. And now they're all correctly bandwagons, but what tends to happen is everybody thinks about just carbon or just salinity or just liming, and they don't take it in context. And I give dumb examples from time to time, but I remember the first time I came across a really acidic paddock here in Wagga. Yeah, the paddock was really acid and the lucerne was failing, and the consultant had recommended the use of limestone, and the poor farmer used lime, but the lucerne was still terrible. When I looked at the soil test for myself, I couldn't help noticing that it was an extremely saline site. It was a very low-lying area. But because everybody's focus had been on acidity and lucerne, no one had looked at salinity. Likewise, we tend to simplify things one bit at a time. We don't look at the whole farm system sometimes. And so you might get yourself all worked up over the fact that we've got to manage a particular variety, a particular way. But if it doesn't suit that environment, for example, we were very keen on getting pulses into our environment, but some of them just don't handle acidity. And it doesn't matter if they're worth a lot of money. If they don't suit the soils you've got, there's no point growing them. I'm always being hammered by consultants who are critical of scientists, because as scientists, we like to do what's called reductionist work. We vary one factor at a time and work out what causes change in soil acidity or phosphorus or salinity, but we don't look at the agronomic context, the soil type, the range of species, the rotation, the climate. We tend to be very narrow as researchers, but a farmer and a consultant have to manage a whole ecosystem. And I think my most humbling learnings were dealing with farmers who saw my research as probably 5 to 10% of the things they had to think about. And sometimes it just wasn't worth their effort thinking about what I thought was important.
Do you think farmers are getting it right at that grassroots level? Do you think that they're soils, they're getting it right there, or are they thinking too much about the profit and not so much about what that they should be getting right at that grassroots level?
I think farmers have got a good balance. I never cease to be amazed at how farmers can balance soils, agronomy, machinery, herbicides, grain storage, marketing. And at the same time, they don't just think profit, they think about the stewardship of their land.
A lot of young advisors and consultants, researchers entering the soil and agronomy world. So what's the advice that you'd give to that next generation coming through?
Look, I think I've made every mistake that can be made, so I am an expert at this one. When I started, I was appointed here to work on soil acidity, and we knew that the main toxin was aluminium. And my whole focus was just measuring the best measure I could get of aluminium for plant growth. And I didn't really care much about all the other nutrients. I didn't care much about varieties. I didn't care much about the climate. And a lot of my research was thoroughly irrelevant to farmer practice. So my advice to young researchers is, maintain the enthusiasm for your scientific specialty, but surround yourself with cynical old bastards who have been around for 30 or 40 years, other researchers, advisors, farmers, people you can pick up the phone to or drop in on and say, I want to do this, what do you reckon? And so I was really fortunate to have a great group of farmers, consultants and senior scientists that I could go to.
And from your career, it was long spanning over three decades. What were some of the big lessons that you learnt from your career?
I think the most humbling lesson is that there's not much new under the sun. There's a bit more technology behind it and a bit more what we might call scientific understanding. But it's really quite depressing to read a paper from 1918 that says exactly what you just proudly published in 2018. So it really pays to read the historic literature and keep yourself in perspective when you think you've done something clever.
That's retired soil chemist Mark Conyers with a bit of advice, speaking there with Cara Jeffrey. That doesn't mean it's time to head off to the livestock market, starting today at Bendigo with Jenny Kelly.
Good afternoon. Packed yarding of 36,000 lambs as the rising price has led to the biggest sale held so far this spring. Full field of meat buyers with no New South Wales markets today due to a public holiday. There was also strong competition from Ballarat restockers. Compared to last Monday, the good trade in export lambs were $12 to $20 dearer as the market caught up to the dearer rates of late last week. The heaviest suckers over 28 kilos carcass from 240 to a top of 259, noting that agents were still selling when this market report was done. Underneath this was a lot of good heavy trade lambs, 24 to 26 kilos from 190 to 218. The average for the best run of these crossbreds was 210. The good 22 to 24 kilo suckers, 175 to 205 for most. Medium processing lambs, 20 to 22 kilos, 160 to 188. Across the yarding, there was a price spread of around 750 to 860 cents a kilo, partly due to quality, which was more mixed this week for both breed type and carcass finish. But this range could be tightened up to between 800 to 830 cents a kilo for the bulk of the neater suckers selling to processors. Competing against trade buyers were Ballarat agents who paid from $180 to $218 for lambs to shear, smaller lambs to the paddock and MK kill processing orders, $135 to $159 for most. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks, Jenny. Now to Mortlake and Chris Agnew.
Thanks, Nikolai. Agents yarded 285 head of cattle at Mortlake this week. There was only a limited number of quality bullocks on offer. Trade steers and heifers didn't display the quality this week. However, there was a very good run of cows of all weights and grades available. All the regular buyers were present plus two extra. Where the market was dearer in places by 10 to 20 cents for the better finished grown cattle and cows, which met strong competition. All other categories were firm. The vealers to the trade made to 436, store buyers paying to 392, yearling steers 373 to 409, the heifers 343 to 398, and the feeders paying up to 380 cents. Grown steers from 330 to 386. The grown heifers making between 310 and 380 cents. Feeders paying up to 384. Manufacturing steers were firm this week at 310 to 335. Heavyweight beef bred cows sold from 310 to 340 cents a kilo this week. Medium beef weight cows made from 266 to 290. The well covered dairy cows made from 266 to 282. Cows back to the paddock sold up to 277 cents and grown beef bulls to 272 cents. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. And now to Pakenham and Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Nikolai. Numbers increased to 1190. That's 390 more with the usual buyers operating in a mixed market. Quality was mixed with a larger selection of prime export cattle and a small proportion of cows. Vealers were limited. Yearling steers gained 5 cents while the heifer portion eased 10. Grown steers lost 10 to processors and gained 10 to feeder orders while bullocks eased slightly. Manufacturing steers eased 10 cents. Cows sold firm to 5 cents dearer and more on some isolated sales with processors loading cows for an estimated 549 to 622 cents a kilogram. Carcass weight. Heavy bulls gained 5. Vealers 359 to 464. Yearling trade steers 390 to 410 after a top of 455. Heifers to the trade 354 to 410. Grown steers 365 to 393. The feeder lots 370 to 406. Bullocks 356 to 388. Heavy Frisians 295 to 324. Crossbreds 320 to 382. Most light and medium weight cows 215 to 297. Heavyweights 250 to 333. heavy bulls to 87 to 315. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much, Brendan. And that is it for the Country Hour for today. Two more rainfall texts to round us out. Trentham, 7 millimetres over the course of the past day, and 33 at Timboon West, but the sun now shining there. Thanks so much for sending through all your texts. News time, 1 o'clock.